Chapter 5. There is one puzzling thing about these prehistoric memories of mine. It is the vagueness of the time element. I lo not always know the order of events, or can I tell, between some events, whether 1, 2, or 4 or 5 years have elapsed. I can only roughly tell the passage of time, by judging the changes in the appearance and pursuits of my fellows. Also, I can apply the logic of events to the various happenings. For instance, there is no doubt whatever that my mother and I were treed by the wild pigs and fled, and fell in the days before I made the acquaintance of Lopir, who became what I may call my boyhood chum. And it is just as conclusive that between these two periods I must have left my mother. I have no memory of my father than the one I have given. Never, in the years that followed, did he reappear. And from my knowledge of the times, the only explanation possible lies in that he perished shortly after the adventure with the wild pigs. That it must have been an untimely end, there is no discussion. He was in full vigor, and only sudden and violent death could have taken him off. But I know not the manner of his going, whether he was drowned in the river, or was swallowed by a snake, or went into the stomach of old Sabretooth, the tiger, is beyond my knowledge. For know that I remember only the things I saw myself, with my own eyes, in those prehistoric days. If my mother knew my father's end, she never told me. For that matter, I doubt if he had a vocabulary adequate to convey such information. Perhaps, all told, the folk in that day had a vocabulary of 30 or 40 sounds. I call them sounds, rather than words, because sounds they were primarily. They had no fixed values, to be altered by adjectives and adverbs. These latter were tools of speech not yet invented. Instead of qualifying nouns or verbs by the use of adjectives and adverbs, we qualified sounds by intonation, by changes in quantity and pitch, by retarding and by accelerating. The length of time employed in the utterance of a particular sound shaded its meaning. We had no conjugation. One judged the tense by the context. We talked only concrete things, because we thought only concrete things. Also, we depended largely on pantomime. The simplest abstraction was practically beyond our thinking, and when one did happen to think one, he was hard put to communicate it to his fellows. There were no sounds for it. He was pressing beyond the limits of his vocabulary. If he invented sounds for it, his fellows did not understand the sounds. Then it was that he fell back on pantomime, illustrating the thought wherever possible, and at the same time repeating the new sound over and over again. Thus language grew. By the few sounds we possessed, we were enabled to think a short distance beyond those sounds. Then came the need for new sounds wherewith to express the new thought. Sometimes, however, we thought too long a distance in advance of our sounds, managed to achieve abstractions, dim ones I grant, which we failed utterly to make known to other folk. After all, language did not grow fast in that day. Oh, believe me, we were amazingly simple. But we did know a lot that is not known today. We could twitch our ears, prick them up, and flatten them down at will. And we could scratch between our shoulders with ease. We could throw stones with our feet. I have done it many a time. And for that matter, I could keep my knees straight, bend forward from the hips, and touch, not the tips of my fingers, but the points of my elbows, to the ground. And as for bird nesting, well, I only wish the 20th century boy could see us. But we made no collections of eggs. We ate them. I remember, but I outrun my story. First let me tell of Lopir and our friendship. Very early in my life, I separated from my mother. Possibly this was because, after the death of my father, she took to herself a second husband. I have few recollections of him, and they are not of the best. He was a light fellow. There was no solidity to him. He was too voluble. His infernal chattering worries me even now as I think of it. His mind was too inconsequential to permit him to possess purpose. Monkeys in their cages always remind me of him. He was monkeyish. That is the best description I can give of him. He hated me from the first. And I quickly learned to be afraid of him, and his malicious pranks. Whenever he came in sight I crept close to my mother and clung to her. But I was growing older all the time, and it was inevitable that I should from time to time stray from her, and stray farther and farther. And these were the opportunities that the Chatterer waited for.
I may as well explain that we bore no names in those days, were not known by any name. For the sake of convenience I have myself given names to the various folk I was more closely in contact with, and the Chatterer is the most fitting description I can find for that precious stepfather of mine. As for me, I have named myself Big Tooth. My eye teeth were pronouncedly large.
But to return to the Chatterer. He persistently terrorized me. He was always pinching me and cuffing me, and on occasion he was not above biting me. Often my mother interfered, and the way she made his fur fly was a joy to see. But the result of all this was a beautiful and unending family quarrel, in which I was the bone of contention. No, my home life was not happy. I smile to myself as I write the phrase. Home life. Home. I had no home in the modern sense of the term. My home was an association, not a habitation. I lived in my mother's care, not in a house. And my mother lived anywhere, so long as when night came she was above the ground. My mother was old-fashioned. She still clung to her trees. It is true, the more progressive members of our horde lived in the caves above the river. But my mother was suspicious and unprogressive. The trees were good enough for her. Of course, we had one particular tree in which we usually roosted, though we often roosted in other trees when nightfall caught us. In a convenient fork was a sort of rude platform of twigs and branches and creeping things. It was more like a huge bird nest than anything else, though it was a thousand times cruder in the weaving than any bird nest. But it had one feature that I have never seen attached to any bird nest, namely, a roof. Oh, not a roof such as modern man makes, nor a roof such as is made by the lowest aborigines of today. It was infinitely more clumsy than the clumsiest handiwork of man as we know him. It was put together in a casual, helter-skelter sort of way. Above the fork of the tree whereon we rested, was a pile of dead branches and brush. Four or five adjacent forks held what I may term the various ridge poles. These were merely stout sticks an inch or so in diameter. On them rested the brush and branches. These seemed to have been tossed on almost aimlessly. There was no attempt at thatching. And I must confess that the roof leaked miserably in the heavy rain. But the Chatterer. He made home life a burden for both my mother and me, and by home life I mean, not the leaky nest in the tree, but the group life of the three of us. He was most malicious in his persecution of me. That was the one purpose to which he held steadfastly for longer than 5 minutes. Also, as time went by, my mother was less eager in her defense of me. I think, what of the continuous rows raised by the Chatterer, that I must have become a nuisance to her. At any rate, the situation went from bad to worse so rapidly that I should soon, of my own volition, have left home. But the satisfaction of performing so independent an act was denied me. Before I was ready to go, I was thrown out. And I mean this literally. The opportunity came to the Chatterer one day, when I was alone in the nest. My mother and the Chatterer had gone away together toward the blueberry swamp. He must have planned the whole thing, for I heard him returning alone through the forest, roaring with self-induced rage as he came. Like all the men of our horde, when they were angry, or were trying to make themselves angry, he stopped now and again, to hammer on his chest with his fist. I realized the helplessness of my situation, and crouched trembling in the nest. The Chatterer came directly to the tree, I remember it was an oak tree, and began to climb up. And he never ceased for a moment from his infernal row. As I have said, our language was extremely meager, and he must have strained it by the variety of ways in which he informed me of his undying hatred of me, and of his intention there, and then to have it out with me. As he climbed to the fork, I fled out the great horizontal limb. He followed me, and out I went, farther and farther. At last I was out amongst the small twigs and leaves. The chatterer was ever a coward, and greater always than any anger he ever worked up was his caution. He was afraid to follow me out amongst the leaves and twigs. For that matter, his greater weight would have crashed him through the foliage before he could have got to me. But it was not necessary for him to reach me, and well he knew it, the scoundrel. With a malevolent expression on his face, his beady eyes gleaming with cruel intelligence, he began teetering, and with me out on the very edge of the bough, clutching at the twigs that broke continually with my weight. 20 feet beneath me was the earth. Wildly and more wildly he teetered, grinning at me his gloating hatred. Then came the end. All four holds broke at the same time, and I fell, back downward, looking up at him, my hands and feet still clutching the broken twigs. Luckily, there were no wild pigs under me, and my fall was broken by the tough and springy bushes. Usually, my falls destroy my dreams, the nervous shock being sufficient to bridge the 1,000 centuries in an instant, and hurl me wide awake into my little bed, where, perchance, I lie sweating and trembling, and hear the cuckoo clock calling the hour in the hall. But this dream of my leaving home I have had many times, and never yet have I been awakened by it. Always do I crash, shrieking, down through the brush and fetch up with a bump on the ground. Scratched and bruised and whimpering, I lay where I had fallen. Peering up through the bushes, I could see the chatterer. He had set up a demoniacal chant of joy, and was keeping time to it with his teetering. I quickly hushed my whimpering. I was no longer in the safety of the trees, and I knew the danger I ran of bringing upon myself the hunting animals by too audible an expression of my grief. I remember, as my sobs died down, that I became interested in watching the strange light effects produced by partially opening and closing my tear-wet eyelids. Then I began to investigate, and found that I was not so very badly damaged by my fall. I had lost some hair and hide, here and there, the sharp and jagged end of a broken branch, had thrust fully an inch into my forearm, and my right hip, which had borne the brunt of my contact with the ground, was aching intolerably. But these, after all, were only petty hurts. No bones were broken, and in those days the flesh of man had finer healing qualities than it has today. Yet it was a severe fall, for I limped with my injured hip for fully a week afterward. Next, as I lay in the bushes, there came upon me a feeling of desolation, a consciousness that I was homeless. I made up my mind never to return to my mother and the chatterer. I would go far away through the terrible forest, and find some tree for myself in which to roost. As for food, I knew where to find it. For the last year at least I had not been beholden to my mother for food. All else he had furnished me was protection and guidance. I crawled softly out through the bushes. Once I looked back, and saw the chatterer still chanting and teetering. It was not a pleasant sight. I knew pretty well how to be cautious, and I was exceedingly careful on this my first journey in the world. I gave no thought as to where I was going. I had but one purpose, and that was to go away beyond the reach of the chatterer. I climbed into the trees, and wandered on amongst them for hours, passing from tree to tree, and never touching the ground. But I did not go in any particular direction, nor did I travel steadily. It was my nature, as it was the nature of all my folk, to be inconsequential. Besides, I was a mere child, and I stopped a great deal to play by the way. The events that befell me on my leaving home are very vague in my mind. My dreams do not cover them. Much has my other self forgotten, and particularly at this very period. nor have I been able to frame up the various dreams so as to bridge the gap between my leaving the home tree and my arrival at the caves. I remember that several times I came to open spaces. These I crossed in great trepidation, descending to the ground and running at the top of my speed. I remember that there were days of rain and days of sunshine, so that I must have wandered alone for quite a time. I especially dream of my misery in the rain, and of my sufferings from hunger, and how I appeased it. One very strong impression is of hunting little lizards on the rocky top of an open knoll. They ran under the rocks, and most of them escaped, but occasionally I turned over a stone and caught one. I was frightened away from this knoll by snakes. They did not pursue me. They were merely basking on flat rocks in the sun. But such was my inherited fear of them, that I fled as fast as if they had been after me. Then I gnawed bitter bark from young trees. I remember vaguely the eating of many green nuts, with soft shells and milky kernels. And I remember most distinctly suffering from a stomachache. It may have been caused. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.